Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast that will never produce a tell-all White House memoir. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangieu Ward. Hello, people.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
Let's talk about how to cut Peter Suderman's mic. But first, there's a healthcare problem in this country. The government keeps expanding its reach and seems to be stumbling in the direction of Medicare for all. So listen up. If you are on a healthcare.gov plan, it's time to ditch it. Try something new. CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is not insurance. It's an alternative way to pay your healthcare bills. No surprise bills, no doctor networks, just a thing between you and your doctor without interference from the government or health insurance companies. Check them out at joincrowdhealth.com. Enter the promo code REASON and start as low as $99 a month for 3 months. Visit joincrowdhealth.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, we're talking about Ukraine. That's what I meant to tease up at the beginning. On Saturday, President Joe Biden signed into law a $40 billion package of military and humanitarian aid to Ukraine, bringing the total amount of pledged U.S. dollar bills for Ukraine during this three-month-old war with Russia to $54 billion. Only 11 Republican senators opposed the bill, along with 57 Republican members of the House of Representatives. Peter Suderman's favorite Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, underscored official GOP support for the package by traveling last week to Kiev, Sweden, and Finland. The latter of two countries are now fast-tracking themselves to membership of NATO. Quote from McConnell, "Skepticism about NATO expressed by the previous president is not the view of Republicans in the Senate." Okay, then. The war itself seems to be settling into a bloody stalemate, with Russia finally taking Mariupol and Ukraine scoring some minor victories in its attempts to dislodge Russian troops from the Donbas region. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky has angrily rejected calls for a ceasefire from Germany, France, and Italy, saying that that would reward the aggressor. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, who we can all name, Julianne Smith, said in Warsaw Friday that, quote, "In terms of the end state, we believe we will see Ukraine prevail, and we want them to protect their territorial integrity and their sovereignty. We want to see a strategic defeat of Russia. We want to see Russia leave Ukraine," end quote. Catherine, let's pick it up there. Does American talk of strategic defeat of Russia, coupled with these huge zoomings of American money, set off alarm bells for you?
You know, I think one thing that UN ambassadors are really, really good at is choosing their words carefully. And those words were carefully chosen, right? So it's like, well, I want a pony. Like, I want magical powers. But, you know, what am I going to...
What about a pony? With
yes, absolutely.
Powers. They had those in the 1980s.
They did. I had a whole box of them and a special stable that they could frolic in. So I absolutely was a My Little Pony girl. I will not be taking questions.
Now they're making ice cream for Squatty Potty. So, you know, times are tough all over.
The word choice is clearly was clearly significant there. It was not the U.S. will be suiting up to go execute that strategic defeat. But yes, I think, you know, sending the amount of aid to Ukraine, which at this point is the equivalent of more than a third of Ukraine's pre-war GDP, right? Like, this is the thing that I have realized is, like, American dollar numbers for us, it's like 40 billion, 50 billion. This has, like, ceased to have meaning. This is not big money for the United States. And that is messed up in 80,000 different ways that we can talk about. But for Ukraine, that's so much money. That's all the money for Ukraine. And I think that does come with both an implied obligation. Are we going to keep supplying that level of money? If so, how long? And does it matter to us how that money is used? Obviously, yes. We know that they are using it for the war effort. I do think, though, that there is an important distinction between like, I think we have rightly preserved the distinction between supporting Ukraine in a kind of lend-lease style format as opposed to actually entering the war, and that people who are kind of hand-waving that away, you know, they're getting it wrong. There is a very, very important diplomatic distinction between those two things, and we are right to preserve that distinction.
I think it's important to recognize that Lend-Lease, and I mean, that's what everybody's calling this Lend-Lease 2.0 and whatnot. Lend-Lease was not, merely support in World War II for the countries under siege from the Nazis. It was a clear step, that FDR was pushing to get us involved in the war in terms of troops and things like that. And I worry about this escalation, the way that we're talking about it, and the way when a UN ambassador, a NATO ambassador is saying, we want a strategic defeat. We want them out of this. We want this. We have sided with Ukraine. We are effectively working with Ukraine. And at this point, I think what we need is an authorization of the use of military force or some kind of very clear ground rules that come out of Congress to say, this is what we're doing and these are the circumstances we're doing it at. Because this is the way that you tiptoe into a war, and in Vietnam, it was, sending military advisors and things like that. I'm genuinely concerned because there is every reason when you think about American foreign policy, and I think this was absolutely made crystal clear under Bill Clinton that we are going to do things in foreign policy that are expressly predicated upon domestic issues that a president is going through. So we're going to, if Monica Lewinsky is testifying, we're going to bomb somewhere. If there's an impeachment trial, we're going to bomb somewhere. Joe Biden is in such a terrible position. And actually a war. Look at this. He's got like more Republican support for this than just about anything he could imagine. I really don't like this. I want the people of Ukraine to be free and independent. I think NATO should be leading the charge, particularly the European members of NATO. But I don't like this. We are creeping into a war. We have chosen a side. And the next step is to actually start doing things like no-fly zones and things like that, because the logic is going to be, well, we all agree we need to get Russia out of Ukraine. And just giving them a ton of stuff isn't going to do it. So maybe now we have to help support them, et cetera. I think this calls for a lot more, kind of actual argument and negotiation or whatever you want to call it, deliberation in Congress.
The Democratic House Majority Leader, Steny Hoyer, has actually made the political connection quite explicit. Not too long ago, he said, it is unfortunate that in a time of war, we're spending all the time blaming our own president. And then a little bit later says, I really wish we'd get off this. This is a fight about like energy production in the United States. I really wish we'd get off this and really focus on the enemy. I know there's a lot of politics here, but we're at war. We need to produce energy. And just explicitly saying, hey, Republicans, we're at war, basically. You can't criticize Biden.
It's a little bit confusing to think of this as a purely domestic play when you have Mitch McConnell flying out to the region and saying, we totally support Ukraine. I mean, it's a popular thing. And also, Joe Biden has very explicitly said there's going to be no discussion of a no-fly zone. So I'm trying to untangle your logic, Nick, in terms of you would like to see a discussion for the authorization of use of military force in order to reject the authorization of the use of military.
Look, you know what? I mean, we have talked about on this podcast and throughout the pages of Reason for 1,000 years now, right? That Congress needs to be clear and Congress needs to be leading on any kind of use of force and things like that. And at this point, all we are seeing is a president who is pushing stuff that is, I guess politically popular. The polls in the country, I don't think there's a strong sentiment for Americans becoming engaged in Ukraine with troops on the ground and things like that. But this is the way that you get into it. It's, this is just the tip type stuff. And, what happens? What happens next after a bunch of American stuff there gets destroyed and maybe some American people were there to teach people how to use it, et cetera. I mean, we should not act as if, okay, well, this is it. All we're doing is we're giving them $40 billion. And then it's like, but we got to give them, extra batteries for everything we're giving them. And then we got to do this. We got to do that. This is a textbook example of how you kind of ease into an actual shooting war with a major adversary, but also one that is not in a direct endangerment to the United States and to our national interests. And that sounds terrible, you know, but that's the fact. Like, if we are going to intervene because Ukraine really needs our help, that's a terrible precedent for foreign policy.
But what about the precedent of we are going to, I mean, let's say what's on the table is the $40 billion or $54 billion, right? Which has gone out the door and now assuming, you know, one third the size of the economy, which is a crazy amount of money in context. But that's what's not on the table so far is actual boots in the ground involvement, no fly zone. So you're saying that this could lead to that, and which is a very, you know, rational slope to imagine because we've seen it so many times before. But there's also the precedent of here's a large country that swallows up its neighbor, and the international community has an interest in creating a taboo for that. And for helping out the country who's a victim of that. What should be done to enforce that taboo if not sending help to the people being attacked?
Well, you know, first off, the UN, you know, which we didn't discuss, but, you know, this seems to be something that the UN might be interested in. NATO is interested, and we saw early on countries like Germany, countries like Poland, Great Britain, France, Italy, like it is their duty. You know, they should be the people who are leading all of this, not the United States.
Catherine, the size of our commitment, which we've talked about already a bit, does that give the United States a material, you know, say or a responsibility to help shape the terms of the peace and actually to speed up those talks?
I think it is just as likely to backfire as it is to help in that regard. And this is something that we talk about with all other kinds of large government expenditures. You know, money comes with strings, and it's not clear to me that the people pulling those strings will be the most competent puppeteers in our midst, just to make the metaphor a thing. You know, I think that it is equally possible that the U.S. could believe that that money gives the U.S. government some say over how the peace is or isn't brokered, and that they could screw it up. They could make it worse rather than make it better. You know, I'm very sympathetic to Nick's concern about this slippery slope, for sure. And in fact, that, you know, there was an AUMF that was proposed for Ukraine, and it was garbage. It was written in such a way that it had it sort of created an end date or an expiration that was essentially at the discretion of the president, you know, when he feels that Ukraine's territorial sovereignty has been restored or something like that. Very unclear what that would mean. So, you know, I think that there is, of course, a danger that we will go down the slope. On the other hand, we do give foreign aid to countries in all states of various kind of conflict, threatened conflict, whatever. And we do interfere in the affairs of those nations sometimes, but I don't think in every case we end up in a hot war with their enemies, right? And so I think that that is not the only path that we could end up on. I also have been, like, I saw this headline that Pete Buttigieg was out here already doing the next Marshall Plan. The headline was like, Buttigieg backs, you know, says U.S. backs new Marshall Plan to rebuild
the
Ukraine.
The transportation secretary, right?
First
you
of
know,
all,
they need
yeah.
light rail. Ukraine
a
needs
little,
trolley cars, for God's sake.
A little
sake.
Bold for a transportation secretary to take that upon himself. But also, that's 100% not what actually happened. It's the 75th anniversary of the Marshall Plan, and Buttigieg was addressing the German Marshall Fund. So, yes, he made some reference to the Marshall Plan in his remarks. That is not exactly the same thing as U.S. Transportation Secretary declares new Marshall Plan for Ukraine. And so it's always worth, you know, reading the fucking article.
You know, right? If we need to read articles as well as headlines in an age of media overload, I don't know. What is her job?
You don't accept the. Yeah.
Can I throw in, as long as we're talking about the Marshall Plan, though, that, you know, the Marshall Plan is one of the most misunderstood mythic, you know, heroic things that we supposedly did and saved Europe. From an economic point of view, there's very little reason to believe that what aid the U.S. gave to Europe immediately, you know, between 1948 and 51 was actually helpful. And when you look at things like the German economic miracle that came after that was due to Konrad Adenauer and Ludwig Erhard, his finance or, you know, his treasury minister, finance minister, economic advisor, who is a member of the Mont Pelerin Society. That's something that Americans could be learning from. They deregulated the economy in a massive way. And it was basically after the Marshall Fund and all of the rules and regulations that placed on the countries that received aid. It was, you know, Germany grew because the Marshall Plan ended and or they ignored it. And that's just kind of another thing. But the Marshall Plan, like the GI Bill, I think is just one of the most oversold kind of government programs that always deserves like a critical you know, a critical analysis whenever it comes up.
It's certainly telling that of the three main prongs, maybe even four, of U.S. actions after the end of World War II. It is the one where we threw money at it is the one that is lionized by everyone. Much less lionized is us helping Western European countries, encouraging them very strongly to create free trade amongst them in a common coal market and common other types of markets, and also to provide security guarantees for everybody so that they wouldn't have to spend all of their money immediately on rebuilding their military capabilities. And the fourth would be to all the just generalized institution building that went on there. Peter, just this morning, Joe Biden said in response to a reporter's question that, yeah, the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily in case of a Chinese invasion. That is a rhetorically, at least, a an escalation from existing kind of muddle of U.S. policy of like, yeah, we're going to help Mao, but we're not going to explicitly say this and whatnot. So just generally, how is the Peter Suderman doomsday clock going?
Well, for me personally, totally independent of Joe Biden, Ukraine or Taiwan, it's going like I'm it's a 1 minute to midnight. So, but for the world, look, I just think that there is a real risk of accidental escalation here through a combination of policy and rhetoric. I mean, you look at the $40 billion in aid, so much of the rhetoric around it assumes that it is in some sense there to aid, Ukraine's war, but it's really America's war, and that really the goal of this is to defeat Russia in some resounding sense. I mean, that is the way this is being described, and that's bad. Like that isn't the goal, or at the very least, it shouldn't be. And that doesn't mean that Ukraine's cause isn't just, and it doesn't mean that Putin isn't a bad guy. Ukraine's cause is just. Putin's a bad guy, and we are already involved. But I think that what's missing here is a clear articulation of the limits that America is going to place on itself in terms of its involvement in all of these global affairs. Because the risk is that if the U.S. signals an appetite for unlimited escalation, then Russia or China or whoever is going to say, well, look, if the U.S. is all in, then I guess we have to be as well. And that's when things go really bad, when you are in a standoff with a nuclear power. And I guess I worry that the Biden administration does not have a plan. For example, if Russia decides to use a single small nuclear weapon inside Ukraine, or even a couple of them, right? Is that in one way, that's obviously an escalation, right? That's a huge like game changer in terms of global affairs. In another way, that is just more of the war between Russia and Ukraine that is not technically our war. And I don't think anybody knows what we're going to do if that happens. You can't respond in kind in a really direct way. So it's just really not obvious how all of this plays out. And it could be very bad. And whenever you're talking about nuclear weapons, very bad isn't monkeypox, and it's not, you know, another pandemic that was very bad. It's something much worse, potentially. I mean, it's, you know, hundreds of millions of humans dead in a period of minutes because of a misunderstanding. And I just feel like the Biden administration in particular is not being careful in the way they talk about the U.S.'s role in all of these conflicts globally.
You know, one upside is Russia, in a profound way, has already lost. Or Putin, NATO is going to be bigger. You know, at the end, whenever this ends, NATO is going to be bigger than it was at the start, which clearly was one of his concerns, you know, a sense of encroachment on a traditional Russian sphere of influence. This war is already a failure, even if he ultimately wins. It's an embarrassment. And I don't think it would be surprising if this leads to the end of his regime. Not unlike the way, you know, the Soviet disaster in Afghanistan was on a larger scale, but it presaged, you know, it was an indicator that domestically the people in the Soviet Union couldn't ignore. And something similar is going on with that here. I mean, Russia has been revealed for all of the horror and all of the destruction and death that it's raining down on people. It's really it's a feeble power. So in a lot of ways, the longer run, the longer run objectives of kind of taking Russia out of geopolitics as a serious player and as a major economic force that can kind of fool around with other people's economies is already being blunted. So that's a positive thing.
I also think the rhetorical sloppiness of the way that the Biden administration has pursued this is a little bit sort of telling. It's symptomatic of the way that the Democratic Party under Biden has pursued domestic policy goals, right? So they have not been able to set priorities and negotiate towards some sort of second best compromise in terms of Biden's policy agenda. Now, from a libertarian perspective, that might be basically good because all of those ideas are crappy and we don't want to see them passed in many cases. But what it also shows is they don't The Democratic Party, as conceived today, doesn't really have a good idea about how to negotiate towards a sort of second best policy, like this is what we can actually get, especially with parties who are like arguing with each other, who are in dispute. Like the Democratic political coalition, as we know it right now, is just unwilling to grapple with trade-offs. And I think we see a lot of that in the Ukraine rhetoric, where it's like, this is going to be the moment where Russia is put in its place on the global stage. And that's it's not just a bad way of getting what you want. It's also really dangerous in a high-risk conflict with a nuclear power.
All right, let's go a little bit early to our listener email of the week. Reminder, send your pithy queries, that's TH, people, to roundtable@reason.com. This intriguing one comes from Curtis Everett, who writes, I work as a rural mail carrier for USPS. I am confronted on a daily basis with stupidity and bureaucracy. My question is, how do you fight bureaucracy, not only from the post office, but government in general? Is bureaucracy ever good? Is it always harmful? Catherine.
This question gave me a whole crisis, I have to say, and I appreciate a question that does that. I really do. Because, on the one hand, this sort of anything that creates a bunch of rules and structures and regulations around normal human activity is bad. That like sentiment, I think, is a deeply libertarian one. I think lots of people who identify as libertarians, like that is the genesis of their political beliefs, is that they looked at some big, dumb bureaucracy and said, this has got to go. And so I think that's like a good and wholesome place for people to come from. On the other hand, as I've discussed on this podcast in the past, I have a horrible, horrible weakness for personality tests and especially Myers-Briggs. And I once saw a description of ENTJs, which is what I am, as your idea of hell is that someone else is in charge and they're doing it wrong. And no one has ever looked into my soul more deeply than that sentence, because my feeling when I see big, dumb, stupid bureaucracies, I know should be, and sometimes is, blow up the whole thing. But my temptation is, no, not all bureaucracies are bad. Stupid bureaucracies are bad. But there are ways of building, guardrails and rules and standards and norms that are actually good and useful. And that if you see the word bureaucracy in a Reason headline, it's never going to be a story about something we endorse. So basically, our answer institutionally is all bureaucracies are bad. Fuck that noise. But that's not quite true. We just use the word bureaucracy to mean structures that are sometimes irksome, that we don't enjoy, but there are structures that are sometimes irksome that are good for society. And so I guess I only like voluntary bureaucracies or something. It's an unsatisfying answer. Thank you for causing an existential crisis in me, dear letter writer.
Nick, are voluntary bureaucracies somehow noble in ways that was?
You know, I've had positive experiences with government bureaucracies. There were a couple years ago, I got letters from the IRS, which I really could not understand. Like, they all said at the top, this is not a bill. And then I don't know, you know, by the time I got to the bottom, I was like, is this a subpoena or a summons or an indictment? I didn't know. And I called the number and I got through on the first time and I talked to somebody and they walked me through it and they gave me a couple of answers and said, do this and then don't worry about it. And that was good. You know, a bureaucracy.
Wasn't getting the letter in the first place, though, a sign of a bad bureaucracy?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, obviously, you know, it's not great. But what if we get away from bureaucracy and start thinking about stuff like customer service, the question is, you know, is a system responsive to the people that it's trying to serve and or, you know, oppress and things like that? And I also, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, which for a very long time had the absolute worst DMV, you know, of all the DMVs in hell. You know, they all got their, you know, their ideals from the New Jersey DMV, which Christy Todd Whitman, a minor character from, in a galaxy far, far away and a long time ago, privatized a big chunk of that. And almost overnight, like the DMV became something that was not particularly awful to go to. So things can change when they get more responsive to the people that they're serving. And I think that's good. We want to live in a rule, in a world of rules, not, or we want to be governed by rules, not men. But then there also are going to be a lot of individual shots that have to be called at various things. And I actually worry these days more about the bureaucracy, not so much in the government, which we take for granted is shitty and is probably not going to improve that much, but in large public companies or companies that and systems that we engage with. And that includes if you're an Amazon reseller, like if you're selling stuff on Amazon, talk to your friends who do that. Amazon is great from the customer point of view. From the seller point of view, it's a nightmare. People are constantly being kicked off or shown the door for reasons that are totally opaque and they can't get in touch. Reason, we are one of the biggest sites on YouTube. We have like 800,000 subscribers and we can't get any information from them when we're dealing with that. And that's, to me, the return of bureaucracy as a kind of loathsome entity that we're all dealing with. This is, you know, what Franz Kafka was writing about. This, you know, became both in public and private institutions in the late 19th through a good chunk of the 20th century. This was a major problem. And I'm actually worrying about how it's starting to come up again and again in private sectors. And that, to me, is like that. I spend more time during my day dealing with that kind of shit than I do with the government, to be quite honest.
Human resources bureaucracy is the real enemy of the people. I just want to chirp in that my all-time favorite bureaucracy interaction was also with the IRS, which was when
you came back. Statists. I am going to like storm out of here old school style.
You're going to like this one, though,
okay,
Catherine,
okay.
On a couple
reserving
of different
judgment.
Levels.
Go ahead.
I didn't file a tax return for about 6 or 7 years on an account of living in Europe and being a dirty hippie. And when I came back to America in the late 90s, I basically called up the IRS and threw myself at the mercy of the crooks. You're supposed to file one even if you're not. I wouldn't have paid a dollar in taxes. And a very nice lady on the other end from Atlanta, I think it was, said, well, how much did you make out there? And I kind of told her, and she laughed. and she said, oh, honey, don't worry about it. So I completely appreciate that. Suderman, what say you about bureaucracy?
I think it's a safe assumption that most places you encounter bureaucracy in the United States, there's probably too much of it. However, if I have to sort of take issue with that assumption and with the thrust of the letter writer's point, it's that if you start from the premise that there's always and forever too much bureaucracy, you can end up at a point where you just say, well, we just want to eliminate all of it and that's all we want to do. And yeah, sure, that definitely appeals to Catherine, and it might feel satisfying in a certain way. But what it does is it doesn't acknowledge the possibility that bureaucracy can be better. And in some places, like, we're not going to get rid of it. So we should, in my opinion, if we can't get rid of bad bureaucracy, we should look for ways to improve it. Nick mentioned the New Jersey DMV, but like, you can have a DMV where the lines are shorter or you don't have to go at all because there's a functional online system, right? And I would just much rather have a functional online system that is like easy to navigate than I would the option of no DMV at all or extremely long lines and terrible customer service, right? There's a middle ground there. And in addition, when government agencies and services actually deliver the basic thing that they promise to do and don't overreach and are like pretty functional, one of the things that does is it increases social trust. And when we have more social trust, that reduces the overall demand for government. This is pretty robust social science finding. And so one of the things that I would encourage libertarians to think about is that if you are trying to make a practical impact, both on the functioning of government as it already exists and on social demand for increases in government services and power, one thing that you should think about doing is asking yourself, well, where is bureaucracy failing and how can we make it simply perform its job in a more straightforward, simple, effective way that actually
lives up to the
promise?
No, I take it back. This whole discussion,
Bob Poole in charge of everything.
This whole discussion has turned me, I take back my previous answer. My answer is now all bureaucracies are bad. Burn it all to the ground. This is the squishiest segment that this show has had in a long time, and I am appalled. I mean, I do think it is important to distinguish between a complex system and a bureaucracy. But I'm actually just going to say, if we're using the word bureaucracy, we should probably eradicate it, especially if it is the state. And I think, although it is true,
so there should be no offices?
We're going to be radically like, atomized,
no offices
floating
anywhere.
Brains and vats individuals. This is the only way forward. Because okay. All
so
of y'all are out here talking about how maybe like
the
if the DMV is really good, people will somehow turn into like libertarians, and that is not the way. Sorry, carry on.
I do think that, look, there are times when when you're not going to improve bureaucracy, right? Like the Nina Jankowicz example, like that, the goal there shouldn't be like to make that a kinder and friendlier disinformation czar, right? That's not what you're looking for.
How many Scaramucci's did the Jankowicz last is my question.
Yeah, that's true.
I think she made two or three mooches.
Measure of time. Yeah. Hey, you know, in 2019, I published an article in Reason that Catherine signed off on called Everyone Agrees Government is a Hot Mess, So Why Does It Keep Growing? Or Why Do We Keep Getting More of It? Which is exactly the point that when we have a functioning government and more trust in government, people demand less of it. That is, so, you know, in a way, the post office is a good example. Like most people like, I guess they like their local letter carrier, unless they happen to be, you know, David Berkowitz or one of those people who is like, you know, keeping mountains of mail at home and soaking it in urine for decades. And, you know, like, how do you get people to throughout the system to act more like a local letter carrier than some kind of, you know, insane, you know, bipolar person who just tells you to fuck off all the time?
I think in answer to the letter writer's question, bureaucracy can be good in theory when it is something that kind of throws sand into the gears of the machinery of the state a little bit, as opposed to public facing kind of consumer oriented bureaucracies. An example, and an example that comes with some caveats, the former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, has one of the many new like Trump era White House memoirs things out right now called The Sacred Oath, where he talks about like Trump at various times, like, I want the military parade in Washington. I want to like withdraw all troops from Germany now. And so the response from the military was like, we'll just do a comprehensive review. So they did I'm sure there's the,
that's
the
deep or state, right? Less sinisterly, so it's the yes minister defense of bureaucracy, right? I mean,
it's the yes.
Yeah.
But
like basically what you want are, you want rules that everybody has to follow that are transparent, that make sense, and that everybody knows. And then like, so when you show up and you say, here, I've got the forms I need, give me my gun license. You don't want a bureaucracy where it's like, it's up to the sheriff to say, you know what? Your handshake was a little clammy and you kind of look Italian. So fuck you. You don't get a gun.
But the question is that the deep, always truth of bureaucracies is that in the end, they are always the sheriff judging you on your clammy handshake. And I think there is
oftentimes
a case for that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. .org to a little discussion about kind of the economy, kind of inflation, kind of stuff. I don't know if all have noticed, but prices are going up and also prices are going down, by which to say inflation continues to go crazy. Interest rates continue to be hiked and whole asset classes, including equities markets and certainly crypto, have been going down a lot. I note today on Monday morning, I think the S&P has come back a little bit from its bear market status from last week. But we're kind of in this uncertain and highly fluctuable, that's right, moment here. And I just want to get the brains around this table to think about a thing, which is, I think if there's one lesson from Michael Lewis's The Big Short, is that it's hard to wrap your mind around a big number. Even the smart people who say it's coming, they can't imagine the bigness of the number. So if we can go round, and starting with Catherine, there will be impacts on public policy, on government, on stuff. Should we continue to be in this place where inflation is up, interest rates are up, and certain classes of asset prices are going down? So in what way, Catherine, looking around, do you see that being potentially impactful on our world?
Yeah, I think the biggest, simplest way in which this is going to impact our world is the cost of servicing our debt. And that is just, you know, many of the impacts of inflation are complicated and multifactorial and hard to think about. But, you know, just there's this very, very simple thing, which is, okay, you know, last year at some point, the CBO said, you know, we are really looking at like an increase in interest rates that is going to create a situation where debt becomes more expensive. This is just like a very simple, simple thing. And all the estimates from that like somewhat catastrophic prediction of last year were too low. So the Fed has already raised interest rates earlier than projected. That means those costs are going to rise faster. So, you know, just for example, interest costs in 2021 were about $20 billion higher than the agency had projected for the previous year. And, you know, the costs for the 6 months of the following fiscal year are already $42 billion more. Like, just all of these numbers sort of spiral. They build on each other, and there is going to be pretty soon it will be true that the biggest program of the federal government is just paying our interest costs, right? Like, on the pie chart of like what are the Fed spending money on, interest is going to be a huge slice of the pie, and that's bad. Even if you, like me, are not once it gets bad enough, then people will discover fiscal discipline, because I don't think that's going to happen. I think it'll just keep getting worse and worse, and no one will ever discover fiscal discipline until a disaster. But there has to be at least some people trying to reckon with that. And that is probably not going to result in like a super rational reallocation of resources. It is going to result in, you know, mathematic shenanigans and lots of hiding the ball, and then we wait for the disaster to come.
It's kind of funny.
By this time next year, we're going to be spending all federal dollars will be spent on servicing the debt and helping Ukraine.
That's it.
That's my prediction.
That's the whole business of the U.S. government is just debt service and Ukraine aid.
And keeping rural delivery post office, letter carriers.
It's kind of funny that Democrats have spent the last year or so griping about how student loan debt really cripples someone's budget. Because it's just so hard to have all that debt that you have to pay back every month, right? Because like then you don't have money for other stuff, you know? At the same time.
Well, maybe they're setting it up.
Household budgets aren't the same as federal budgets. It's complicated, blah, blah, blah. But like, every single CBO report going back for, you know, as long as they have been issuing these budget outlooks just says the same thing, which is that the higher the debt is, the more cost that creates for doing anything else. It makes it harder to act in an emergency, and it also just makes it harder to do regular stuff. It also creates a risk, because a lot of the debt buildup has come during times of low interest rates. And if interest rates are to rise, then the cost of servicing the debt, already quite expensive, already projected to get a lot more expensive, goes up and could be catastrophic.
I think maybe they're softening the ground to be like, oh, you know what? We're not going to forgive student debt. We're going to forgive our own debt. We're going to be magnanimous.
We're going to forgive ourselves. That's what we all learned we needed to do in therapy. That's enough.
I think so. Yeah. It is true. I don't know if any of you guys had this. At various points, I was, you know, probably in terms of credit card debt, like monthly minimum payments and things like that was eating up. This was right around the time that I was in grad school and just after. You know, it was sucking up like, you know, 30% of my take home pay and things like that. And that is brutal. And, you know, the federal government is going to get to a point where it's going to be 50%, you know, where it's going to be the single largest program. That's like brutal. It's clear that the government's not going to do anything about that. Interestingly, with some pension plans, some state run pension plans, if the government starts having to pay more in order for people to buy their shitty bonds, like that actually might have a beneficial effect on some public pension plans. But the hope ultimately, especially with the collapse of asset classes, but it would be much better in all of that. And again, if we can draw other lessons from this, is to get states out of defined benefit plans and into defined contribution plans. If we can educate people to understand why investing in diverse portfolios for your retirement and for everything else are really important, at least we can squeeze some kind of knowledge out of something that is really becoming very, very bad.
It's a shout out to the Reason Foundation's Pension Integrity Project program, whatever the third word is there. For working on this issue for a long time. A lot of state-run pension programs have these really unrealistic gains targets, like, oh yeah, we're going to make 7% every year. And if they don't, then sometimes that shortfall has to be, by law at least, made up from the general fund for the state budgets, which is a disaster. Especially in places where, as Nick said, you have a defined benefit, when you say we're going to pay you this amount of money, not we're going to put that amount of money and manage it in the stock market and we'll see where it goes. The Pension Integrity Project has been trying to get people more into the defined contribution business. But every time the stock market goes down, it's a margin call for some people. And one of the biggest categories of some people are state managed pension funds. We live, Nick and I, in New York, or the comptroller has been, during the long kind of a run-up of stock prices, spending a lot of time doing things like finger-wagging about divesting from oil companies and making sure that there are climate impact disclosures on people's SEC forms. And just this past week, or in the last 10 days, browbeating various Wall Street bigwig companies like Goldman Sachs to have a voluntary disclosure of the ethnic and gender and race status of all of its board members, which gets into creepy territory really quick. Something about having your actual pension under portfolio going underwater might snap you back into attention, although I wouldn't count on that, because it's New York, and New York is governed like a sewer. Okay, let's go
governed
to our...
Governed like a sewer. I don't know how our sewers governed.
I've been in some extremely well-run sewers, Matt.
Down the street from basically an open sewer. Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest Superfund projects. Every day, I see human excrement. All right, let's go to our...
greatest city in the world. Definitely keep living there.
State capacity, libertarianism for the win in the Gowanus Canal. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming besides state capacity, libertarianism. Catherine, do you want to start us off?
I'd love to start us off. I had a friend in town this weekend, which means that I went to a museum.
Nice.
Because the two times that I go to a museum are when someone is in from out of town or when I have nothing to do with my children. And so we go to a museum because it's a thing to do. I went to the Renwick, which the museum that is right across from the White House and yet 1,000 times better than anything that happens within the White House virtually always. And I particularly want to commend to you Janet Echelman's 1.8 Renwick, which was a hugely popular installation that they had when they had the Wonder exhibit a few years back. They brought it back. It is there for, I think, another month or two. And it's this sort of very complex web of threads. It's hung from the ceiling. And you go in, and if it is, for instance, like 95 degrees and you just walked to the museum, it's then very, very cold in the museum. And then you lay on the floor and you look up at this beautiful thing, and the lights around it kind of move and change. And if you are like me, you take an opportunity to reflect on the fact that you used to think you were too good for the Renwick, because the Renwick is technically arts and crafts. It is not the, you know, real art. And that you were like, who has time for these quilts when there's a Calder to look at? And you think you were wrong about that. And that actually arts and crafts museums are kind of great. And that this particular installation, one of the best among them, and that you should go more often.
Do they have a big macaroni art collection?
See, this is the kind of snobbish, internalized misogyny that I was bringing to my experience of arts and crafts
as one of the manliest of all the virtues.
There is a lot of woodworking in there as well, yeah. And I will admit that my appreciation
using a little pen to etch things in wood
of a finely tuned rocking chair. Maybe I'm not quite there yet. But the quilting is actually very cool. There's some cool quilts there. But I do like the kind of, I'm happy that we are in an era of Instagrammable art. The Renwick has leaned into that specialty, and rightly so.
The Renwick and the National Portrait Gallery are like the two museums, the go-to Welch family museums in Washington, D.C. Like, don't go to any other ones. Just go to those two is my strong recommendation.
It's good advice. That's strong advice.
Nick, what did you consume?
I wanted to ask you first, Matt, have you ever been to Cooperstown?
Still have not. I hope to go this year for the first time.
My God. I know. Jesus. But yeah. Speaking of Matt Welch, I attended a live taping at the Village Underground, which is a comedy club in Greenwich Village, of The Fifth Column. The podcast that Matt has been on along with Camille Foster and Michael Moynihan since 2016. And it was a great scene. It was, you know, I don't know, Matt, how many people? You guys sold out tickets in like 15 minutes
15 hours, but yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Do you know how many people 200 were plus. There? It's like 150, 200, something like that. I mean, it was like a Who concert, you know, with all the drama and the tension and the foreboding of that. And then they had two special guests, the actor Michael Rapaport, who only seems to be mentally challenged. He's actually very funny and very smart. He's a very good actor, most recently in the Hulu series with Amy Schumer, Life and Beth, where he plays her kind of alcoholic, drug-addled father, as well as Colin Quinn, who's just one of the best kind of comedians and social observers of the past, I don't know, you know, 30 or 40 years. But it was really good, and it was very wonderful to see a scene of people, essentially a sea of super fans, everybody enjoying themselves. So I would just recommend to the people who listen to this podcast to check out The Fifth Column, which recently practiced the right of exit and left Patreon to go to Substack, where it's a little bit easier probably to access and to steal episodes from. So The Fifth Column. Particularly
thank you
long.
Very much for that, Nick. The that episode has been posted up there, so if people want to give a listen to Colin Quinn's last minute Hey Kool-Aid arrival there, which is pretty great. Peter, what have you been consuming?
I read the novel Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. She, of course, is the author of the novels Station 11 and The Glass Hotel, as well as a couple of other books. Station 11 is probably her most well-known book. It's a sort of post-pandemic novel, and it takes place sort of after the world has melted down, and it's about a music and acting group that is trying to preserve art after most human beings have died. It's great. Her new one is shorter and a little more elliptical, but it is even more aggressively a science fiction novel, and yet it doesn't quite feel like a science fiction novel. It feels a little more like poetry in its own way, right? It's not concerned with sort of the technical details and the mechanics of spaceships and sort of, it's just sort of like, oh, here is a future in which people live and things are different and there is different technology. Although it's not entirely set in the future. It actually starts in 1912 and then moves forward over the course of several hundred years. It plays out in several different timelines until we get to a future in which humans have colonized the solar system, including the moon, with domed moon colonies, one of which is a domed moon colony where the dome lights just stopped working one day. And so it's always dark, and they call it Night City, and there's a sort of noirish detective aspect.
I think this is exactly what my dad was always yelling about when we were in the car on family vacations, and he was like, don't turn on the dome light, because that was like the worst sin you could commit as a kid.
Well, there are people who have feelings about whether Night City is actually better, even though it's considered the place for kind of outsiders and weirdos. And there's all sorts of little bits about class and culture in here. There's a character who is this section of the book is called The Last Book Tour, and it takes place like 100 or 200 years from now. And it's a woman who has written a pandemic novel and is about to, there's like another pandemic maybe breaking out in Australia as she's on tour, but she grew up on the moon. It's also, I think, the most interesting thing from a reason perspective in this book is that it is also kind of quietly a novel about bureaucracy, since we talked about that earlier. So once you get deep into the book, you realize that there is some time travel. This is not that surprising given the time hopping of the story. And it turns out in the future, time travel is possible, but it's mostly illegal and controlled by a government bureaucracy on the moon. And so we get all of these little lectures in the book about how bureaucracies exist only to protect and preserve themselves and their own power, and how they've like regulated out most uses of time travel, and how the main thing that they do is they demand that the people who are their operators, who they send back in time, they demand that they do inhumane and inhuman things. And the only time that they ever fix the timeline, they pretend that they're just like out there to preserve the timeline for all of us. But the secret is the only time they fix the timeline is when it affects the power of the time bureaucrats. And so it's kind of fascinating.
I stop listening and then I came back and we were talking about Loki? Like.
I thought we were part of this novel now.
So what I'm saying is we need to go back in time and restart this podcast, but with a time traveler and the knowledge of what's going to happen at the very end of it, or maybe even the knowledge of what someone just said a few minutes ago. Since
this may be of not even of interest to Matt, but he's the only one who it might possibly be interest to. But yesterday I was at the airport because I was flying from New York to L.A., and Jim Croce's Time in a Bottle came on. And I was like, but mostly I was like, what the fuck is an airport doing playing a Jim Croce song? Like, are they going to follow it up with the Big Bopper or Buddy Holly or something like that? And for you young people, Jim Croce famously died. He was a singer-songwriter who died.
You might have heard.
There's also a substantial segment set in an airship depot where an old man is playing a violin, and there may be basically a glitch in the Matrix. There's a big thing about like whether or not we're living in a simulation. And in some ways, the book is a philosophical explanation of, well, if so, then what do we do about
that? Does the violin, like, does a spark from the violin cause the Hindenburg to explode, I hope?
No, because it's
because that'd be pretty cool, don't you think?
Cool.
Yeah.
For you kids, Jim Croce's Bad, Bad Leroy Brown is the one song that you have
Thank
heard.
You. I appreciate you making that accessible for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Bad, Bad Leroy. I don't think so. That's filled with racial stereotypes. You know, he demonizes the entire South Side. of Chicago.
He certainly does. I'm not sure that would...
likens him to a junkyard dog?
Hold
Come
up
on.
To scrutiny. So I will confess to having the occasional blind spot when it comes to knowing the existence of cultural products.
This is going to be good.
It's not that good.
You saw The Sound of Music.
I actually saw that a few years ago. It was great.
Is that it?
No, but I'm...
Have you heard of the Beatles?
Not They're as good, good as the Ruddles, but they'll do. But no, as a parent, two kids, one was 13, one's 7, and one of the beloved books, the 7-year-old is currently rereading by herself because she's smart, is E.B. White's classic Charlotte's Web. And so I was just, we're looking for a movie.
Are there any spoiler alerts?
I was looking for a little movie night thing. I'm like, huh, I wonder if they had, like, made any new one since the animation from my childhood. And like, not only did they make one in 2006, but my people, so Dakota Fanning is Charlotte. So we're already starting pretty good. It's Julia Roberts. No, Dakota Fanning is the kid or whatever
her name
is. It's
Dr. Frankenstein's monster, Matt, actually. Yeah.
But Julia Roberts is Charlotte. So she's like, look at this. And like,
does the spider have enormous teeth?
Like a big eyebrows. And
yeah.
She's got a great laugh.
Steve Buscemi is Templeton the rat.
I'm sorry, what?
Oprah Winfrey is a goose. Like Robert Redford is a horse. I had no idea this movie. Danny Elfman does the soundtrack. I had zero idea. It's John Cleese is like a goat or something. I don't even know. Andre 3000 is in it. Kathy Bates is a cow. Like, brought this.
So this was some kind of court-ordered drug.
You had me at Steve Buscemi as the rat, like, because that the rat is the best character in Charlotte's Web. I think we can all agree.
And he's...
Does it morph into a version of Animal Farm at any point? Because that would be pretty cool. That
it's kind of like if you're tired enough and you just are, if you're going to be watching this in any circumstance, it just sort of blends into Babe the Pig because it's all like talking animals and stuff. I think it's shot on the exact same farm. No, it's just amazing to me that this thing, kind of like the Winnie the Pooh movie that came out a couple of years ago, just like came and went and no one said a word. Or if they did, I was out of earshot or something. It's a perfectly fine version of a great, great classic book. So go see Charlotte's Web if you have kids and you're stroking out and it's and it's getting near bedtime. All right.
Would you say it's a veritable smorgasbord of great actors?
Say that.
No, it's not.
Yeah, I don't know. But that is making me think, Matt, you might want to go, like, not now, but in a couple of years, in the Nicolas Cage movie I talked about a week or 2 weeks ago. There's a recurring motif where Nicolas Cage and a couple of the characters stop to watch Paddington 2 as one of the most incredibly moving movies of recent time. And I actually started watching it, and I highly recommend that, Matt. Not enough to make it my recommendation, but Paddington 2.
Is one of the best movies made in the last decade.
What's happening
right
now? I'm
absolutely going to stand by that.
What is happening right now?
It's like, you know, it's like the way that The Godfather 2 is really better than The Godfather.
Those are the only two. The sequel.
This was actually, this brings us perfectly full circle to the Ukrainian opening segment, since, of course, as we remember, who played Paddington in the Ukrainian version?
That is correct. Zelensky. Whose first name I'm never going to try to...
The president of
Sorry.
Ukraine.
Should I
Let's
give his
sure
full
everybody
title
understands.
At all times?
Yes.
Dr. Nicolespi? Yeah.
Yes.
Again.
Absolutely.
All right. That's all the doctoring that we have time for on this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. Go to all of our podcasts, reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Dr. Nicolespi and the Soho Forum debate series with Gene Epstein. There was a recent great one involving Elizabeth Nolan Brown.
It's already up
there. So go check it out.
Legalizing sex work.
And yes, we will catch you next Monday. And if you like what we do at the Reason Foundation, including Bob Poole telling us how to make the bureaucracy work better by getting rid of lots of it and by making it just more market oriented and privatizable, please check out our work at reason.com, reason.org. And if you like it, reason.com/donate. give us the monies. Okay. Thanks. Goodbye.